You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On the West Coast, 11:06 on the East Coast. So if you're counting the minutes till lunch, because you're a fat man, you got 54 minutes to wait. So joining me is a former Marine sergeant, and his name is Craig Grossi, and he is the he's Fred's dad, and so we talked to him on Monday, talked about his experiences in as an intel guy in Afghanistan, as well as his career as a corrections guy. Let me ask you about being a corrections guy. That has to be brutal mentally, because I know people that have done that. That's a rough world, man. How was that?
Well, it's rough on any regard, but for me specifically, like when I enlisted, when I was at boot camp, we invaded Iraq.
Right.
And so my expectations of my time in the Marine Corps were, you know, I was going to Iraq, I was going to Afghanistan, I was going to war. And then after boot camp and MCT, I get told, you know, I'm going to get a whistle and a set of keys and I'm going to, you know, be working in corrections. And they told me I'm going to go work in a brig. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that word. I didn't know what a brig, you know, like, and I was like, what? So add all of that onto, you know, just like going into a field that is in itself, if there is something you wanted to get into, is still really hard, just mentally to manage. And so for a young, 20-year-old Marine that, you know, was really, and a lot of my friends and people that I knew that were in Fallujah and Ramadi and, you know, doing all the stuff that I thought I really wanted to do. And I was scooping chow and, you know, working with handcuffs every day, but it just wasn't really what I wanted to do. So yeah, but as a job, it's a struggle for reasons that I don't think anybody could understand or predict, unless they think it's just one of those jobs that you have to do, or it's like go and see, you know, like what a day in the life of a corrections officer is like, because, you know, you see people in circumstances that are just so unique, and you spend hours, you know, a huge part of your life behind bars, you know, and you see people in that environment, and then it's almost like, and then when you walk out at the end of your shift, it's really strange, to kind of go back and forth from that environment to the regular world. And like, it's just I'm grateful for the experience, and I'll always think of my time in corrections, you know, with fun. I made friends during that time that I still have today. And, you know, going to Gitmo was an experience that, most people will never have, and that was, you know, really valuable. And actually, in terms of when I transitioned into the intel world, just in terms of the lessons I learned and the skills that I was able to develop, specifically in Gitmo. So, you know, it worked out.
Yeah, it sounds like a rough, dark place. What's a good day like as a corrections officer, you know, when you're working, when you're working in a brig? What's a good day?
Yeah, I mean, a good day is, you know, everybody, specifically too, like in the brig I worked in, the prisoners were from all different branches. It was a consolidated brig. So whereas like a Marine brig is like, it's just Marines, and they're just structured a lot differently. And, but anyway, a good day would just be, you know, you go in and you spend your 12 hours in the cell blocks, and you can take the prisoners to chow, and there's no incidents coming and going from chow, and there's no, you know, like incidents in the weight room or the weight area, and it's just kind of boring, for lack of a better word. But, you know, you don't have a ton of paperwork to do because somebody spit on somebody, or because somebody, you know, there's no like security alerts where you can't, you know, prisoners going from point A to point B and they don't show up when they're supposed to or where they're supposed to, and you have to then lock the whole place down while you find, and then you just find out the guy just stopped and went to the bathroom somewhere. So, you know, and so it's just a lot of, it can go wrong real quick and then go right back to being boring, you know, real quick. So but a good day is uneventful. I think that probably goes for any law enforcement or first responders kind of day, though. I mean, if it's exciting, that means something bad is happening. So,
all right. For people who haven't heard the first part of the story, in about 60 seconds, Craig joins the Marine Corps. He goes into corrections. He gets out of the Marine Corps. A prior service recruiter approaches him. He ultimately gets sent to Intel School, and then he winds up deploying to Iraq with 1st Recon Battalion.
Afghanistan.
I'm sorry, to Afghanistan in 2010, and we're there at the same time. I got a chance to watch some of the stuff they did, and they did great stuff. You made some comments about 2nd Recon Relieves, 1st Recon Battalion in Afghanistan, and you had some rough experiences with them. Talk to us about that. What happened after the RIP?
Yeah, the mission changed a little bit for once first ripped out, and instead of going in and spending, you know, a month or, you know, maybe 4 weeks in staying in and then going back to Leatherneck for a break, they decided that we were going to try and hold ground in staying in. And so they, you know, that we went out with 2nd on kind of that same kind of deployment first, or that same kind of trip into Sangin first out of the helicopters. And the very first patrol we went out on, 2nd Recon, you can have the best turnover in the world, and some of the lessons just won't sink in until you see it for yourself. And they unfortunately, that the very first patrol, we went out and tried to hold a compound in the green zone. We were going to do it for 48 hours, but the location wasn't the best in terms of standoff and the preparation for the fight, you know, just wasn't the same as what first had been able to develop over the whole time they've been there. And so they ended up losing a guy, Corporal Osterman, who was just an outstanding Marine and just a kick-ass person in general. But he was a 240 gunner, and he had spent his 2-hour shift up there and on the rooftop post that we had made, and when it was his turn to come down to hand off someone, he said, "I'm not coming down. Like, this business is about to, you know, kick off, and you know, you can come up here, but I'm not coming down. You're going to need me up here." And he was right. They moved in on us, we're able to get up really close, and so close that we could hear them talking to each other during the firefight. And Osterman took out, I think, 2, maybe 3, fighting positions just by himself with his 240. And I think I accounted for like 6 or 7 dead Taliban just with his own gun, before he took one in the head. And then on that night, we were trying to, exfil back to our the other side of the green zone where we had set up the command, was when, the EOD guy, Justin, is a good friend of mine, ended up getting killed, by an IED when we were trying to make our last cross, across the canal. And so that was I attributed to a lot of things, but I think one in general was just kind of just being unfamiliar with the area and just the consequences of not taking, you know, just exhaustive measures in preparation and planning. And but it's also just freaking saying, and that's the way it goes, man. Like the fight was was so intense there, and it took guys like Sean and guys like Justin to step up and do something outstanding and lay their lives down for us to just make it the hell out of there. Because who knows, if Sean hadn't been on that roof, they might have been able to overrun us. And if Justin hadn't been there, you know, it would have been somebody else that stepped on that IED. It would have been, you know, it would have been maybe two or three guys that would have gotten taken out by that IED. So it's it's just tough lessons to learn, but the memories of those guys are always with me, and it's I'm really proud that they're a big part of the book, and they're still a big part of my life. I mean, I'll never let them fade. So
okay, yeah. So Craig, so you come back from that deployment. How long do you stay on active duty? When do you get off active duty?
Pretty much right away. I mean, I had actually extended to go on that deployment. I did my 1 year here. I think you're at the time, or I don't know if it's still that way. You could only extend for a year, so I extended to go. So when I got back, I ended up getting into a reserve unit in Quantico, and we were. Me and the rest of my team were just supposed to kind of hang around this reserve unit for the last month or so of our active duty time, and I wanted to reenlist, and so I was trying to work with the INI staff there to reenlist, and there was a captain and a gunny who were active duty and were just kind of they didn't know us. And so they weren't really invested, and we were just guys that just showed up one day from the deployment. And because we went back to First Intel and checked out from First Intel, and right. Then were sent back to the East Coast.
Okay.
And so anyway, I ended up getting out because I wasn't getting any help reenlisting, and I really quickly found a job at the DIA. You know, just with my clearance and my experience and stuff, it wasn't hard to.
Okay, you said, so with the DIA, explain to everybody what DIA is.
It's the Discount Intelligence Agency. No, I'm just kidding. It's the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's the Department of Defense's, kind of wing. It's the civilian kind of intel collection. They do a lot of stuff, and a lot of it is overt and relatively unclassified, and but then there's other stuff that goes on that is kind of spooky at times, but it's essentially just a big flagpole, in DC, a lot of analysis and kind of an intel collection, and products are made there to be sent around to different heads of state and different people within DC to read about.
Okay, so you have a job offer to go to work for them, and so you decide to get out of the Marine Corps. Okay, all right. All right, keep going. You were going to say something.
It was a pretty easy choice. It was because it was my clearance and everything was lined up, still, and I had there's a little just like any MOS or any field, there's a within Intel, there's a. You can always find it. Throw a rock in a room, you're going to hit a former, Intel Marine, and they kind of look out for each other. And so I had a buddy that got me into with a contracting company to go and work for the DIA. So it was pretty. The options were slim. It was either try and fight my way into reenlisting into the Corps, which didn't really feel like anybody even wanted me. So the unit was just could take it or leave it. So. I decided it was time to make that transition.
Okay. Is the money good at DIA?
Yeah, that helped. Yeah, the money was good, and it was an easy commute to work. I ended up getting an apartment close to work, and it was also across the street from a huge dog park, which was awesome. Fred definitely played a part in that, and I was looking forward to just kind of being able to relax a little bit and hang out with Fred more, and that's what that job was kind of a little bit more attractive for that.
All right, now I want. Okay, so now we got kind of the pattern of your career. The last we heard of Fred on Monday is that you had decided to let Fred decide whether he would follow you on the air, on the helicopter or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would not have done that. I would have picked him up, and I would have brought him. But you're a permissive parent, obviously. You're gonna let you're gonna let your kid make his own choice.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's amazing, given you know animals are comfortable around some things, and like everybody else, the things they don't know, loud explosions, I mean, obviously scare them. A helicopter is not normal. So the fact that he would follow you on is amazing. What did the air crew say when this dog comes on the
once he started following me, that was when I did my, like, once he like took a couple of steps and it was clear he was coming with us to the helicopter, I had a duffel bag in my pocket, and I was like, you know, that was my deal. Like, if you follow me to the helicopter, I'll do my part. And so, the master sergeant, Top was behind me. And once he started following me, he was right on my heel, running through the dust cloud to the back of the 53. I started pulling out this duffel bag that was shoved in my pocket. It was just one of those little kit bags we carry around. And, Top comes up behind me and grabs Fred by the back of the neck, like it's a handle. And we just shoved him in this kit bag. And, Top grabs one side and I grabbed the other, and we tried to make it. And then we were both in the same space. We were like, let's just make this look like gear. And right. So we held it, you know, one hand on the other and on either side of the bag. And there was an air winger tried to stop us and was like, asked Top, like, what's in the bag? And Top, 20 plus year recon guy, you know, like, no, you know, he doesn't like waste any words or time. Just like gave the kid a stiff arm to the chest and was like, "Don't worry about it." And you know, we ran up the back of the bird, and that was how he made it onto the helicopter. I don't think that that we could have just walked up the ramp with him like that. That was a kind of an idea, but they would have. He was so dirty and obviously, you know, not a working dog or anything like that. So.
Yeah, and those things, again, they're all over Afghanistan. You know, and you see pictures of Marines who befriend these things, and they become emotional emotional events for a lot of guys who had to leave dogs that they befriended and became little unit pets. When it was time to go, it was time to go, which is one of the reasons why your story is so unique. So you guys fly to Leatherneck, I assume, yes?
Right. Yep.
Okay, so now Fred's now at Leatherneck. Hopefully you gave him a bath and unnastified him. So tell us, what's next? At some point you redeploy, and at that point I assume that you think your relationship with Fred is over. Maybe somebody else will take care of him. Talk to us about how this evolved.
First of all, he went on a helicopter ride before he ever went on a car ride, which is, I don't know if there's ever been a dog in the history of dogs that could say that, which is pretty cool. But so the way I had it figured out was I had my analyst, Sergio, and one of our radio guys, McGuire, they came to the flight line and picked me up. So cause there was like a whole reception for the recon guys, like with Gatorade and pizza and stuff in the chow hall right on the flight line. I was like, I can't hang around. You know, I can't hang around with Fred stuffed in this bag. So I kind of broke away from everyone, and Sergio and Matt came and scooped me up in a little Hilux and took me back from Bastion to the Leatherneck side of the base. And that was as far as I had planned, like in terms of, you know, I just wanted to get Fred from the flight line back to our room as fast as possible.
Right.
And,
explain to everybody, because this is what Craig's doing is not allowed. Okay.
Yeah.
Just that's why, what are you, a corporal at the time or a sergeant?
Sergeant, yeah.
He's a sergeant at the time. But this is not permitted. You don't sneak animals onto a base. You can't do this, let alone fly him around in a helicopter. Okay,
so, right.
So he's borderline going to get himself in trouble, let alone Fred. Okay, so
right.
hence the covert operation here. All
yeah.
right, keep going.
Yeah, so I'm actually, me and Fred are in the back of the Hilux in the bed, and I'm just like, the gravity of what I had just done is kind of, I'm saying like, okay, like, what now? Like, what the heck are you going to do now? And, I see on the right, so it's like probably, so people that don't know from Camp Bastion is like the air wing. It's like a British run, but the side of the base, but it was where all the helicopters and stuff would come and go from. It's probably about like, I don't remember, like, it felt at times like a long drive, maybe like a 25 minute drive from there back to the other side of Leatherneck where we had like these little bunk rooms.
Right.
And so on that drive, back, I noticed a sign. It was this, like, you know, like a couple feet wide, yellow sign with red letters that just said DHL with a little arrow pointing down this dirt road. And I was like, oh man, like, and that wasn't there when I left. Leatherneck was changing so fast. They were building that place up so fast. And DHL had no presence when I initially left, for Sangus. And so I was like, man, like that, I gotta follow that sign. Like I gotta get myself cleaned up, dust Fred off as best I can. I couldn't give him a bath because I didn't want to take him in the shower room with somebody. At this point, the only people I trusted were Sergio and Mac and the recon guys. But I knew if any, like, the fewer the people that knew about Fred, the better. So I didn't want to try and, like, expose him to any other Marines that I didn't know. And so I couldn't, like, take him in the bathroom and give him a bath or anything like that. So anyway, we got back to the barracks and I cleaned myself up a little bit and, Sergio and Matt hung out with Fred and I went straight over to that DHL compound and, this is just where the story, and it's like all this is, it was really fun for me to write because I remember it so well, the characters that come to play during Fred's time at Leatherneck. And it's really cool to see the workers from DHL and how they responded when they met Fred. Because these are guys from different African countries, the Philippines, you know, Indonesia. They're third country nationals. And their life is rough. And they're away from their families, you know, working on a U.S. military base for as contractors, and like their life is just a forklift and a truck. Like that's all they did was unload and load stuff all day. And here I come with this dog, you know, and they instantly bonded with Fred and they loved him so much and they were, you know, on board right away with taking care of him. While I knew like number one, I'm gonna have to find a place for this dog to stay. Well, I go back because I knew in like a week and a half, like 2 weeks, we were going right back into Sangin. And so that was my number one job was just finding a place for Fred to be where he would be safe and wouldn't be found. And, the DHL guy stepped up and volunteered to take care of him while I was gone. And meanwhile, back in the States, my sister is going, you know, just emailing everybody she can, trying to figure out how we're going to ship him home. And so it's just kind of, you know, lots of different people from different parts of the world and different backgrounds coming together to figure out what to do with Fred. And that's just a really cool part of the book. It's really a testament to, you know, to how awesome Fred is and how, you know, how manipulating he is, I guess, maybe in one way, if you look at it that way. But, yeah, it's just, a really unique. There's a lot of people that were able to get dogs home and from different parts of the world, and you know they're all really fantastic stories. And I don't ever want to diminish anybody's experiences with that, but most of the time it's the circumstances were relatively convenient in terms of like, you spent your whole deployment on a FOB or a base, and that dog was there the whole time, and you had, you know, the time to reach out to your local SPCA or a nonprofit like Puppy Rescue Mission, which wasn't around when I was in Afghanistan, but they're a great nonprofit that helps guys and girls get their pets home from overseas and But with Fred, it was like, it was, had to be so hasty because of the way I was operating and because of the way, you know, the rules were structured. So it's really where our story kind of shines and where the adversity really, makes it special.
Right. The book is called, Craig and Fred, and they can find it on, all I have to do is do a search on Craig and Fred. And it'll pop up. You'll see their mug. Nice beard, by the way. You still have that? You still have that nasty thing?
Oh yeah. I got the nasty. I got the hair too. Yeah.
All right. Your girlfriend doesn't mind, huh?
No.
All right.
I think she wonders what my chin looks like some days. But
All right. So now we got to the point where he's splitting. You're sharing custody with Fred. Between you and the guys over at DHL.
Yeah.
How does he get home? Because that's a big deal, and it certainly was, trying to get an animal that's native to Afghanistan back to the United States. Most people are familiar with stories about dog handlers being reunited with their dogs, you know, after they get out and the dog has been retired from active duty or whatnot. And we see those stories, but we don't see too many stories like yours. How does Fred immigrate?
Yeah, so I mean, it was, I figured out pretty quickly that nobody was going to vaccinate and quarantine a dog I wasn't supposed to have. And that's, if you do it legitimately, like, that's what you do. You have to vet, vaccinate them, and then quarantine them for 30 days after vaccination, and then they're cleared to ship. But it just wasn't, that wasn't gonna, you know, the only vets that on Leatherneck were, you know, for the working dogs, and, right. And they're, you know, liable to report because they're the same ones that gave us, like, the courses when we showed up in country about, you know, like, don't approach stray animals and stuff. So I wasn't going over there. And so the best I could do was I went back to Camp Bastion, and I found where the British Army had their working dogs. And I just walked in and talked to the sergeant major and was like, hey, can I have, like, a little FaceTime with a vet? You know, I just want to ask her some questions. And I'm operating like on a hypothetical. I'm like, hey, like, if I had a dog, you know, and that's how I was approaching everybody. And people usually talk to me, but
that's the equivalent of, like, my friends got a Snapchat account and her boyfriend is sending her, like, right. Is there any way that, are you sure that they can't somehow get these?
Exactly. And so luckily I found this British Army veterinarian, and I was like, look, like, you know, if she saw her through my, you know, hypothetical, and I was like, look, he's a great dog. Like, I'm just trying to get him home. Like, can you at least, I can't ask you to vaccinate him, but, like, would you look at him? Like, just give him an exam. Cause at this point I'm getting him home.
Right.
And I'm going to do whatever it takes. And I just wanted to, you know, do my part to make sure he wasn't, you know, wasn't sick with anything. And she was like, look, like, bring him over here tonight. And, you know, and I'll meet you here and I'll give him an exam. So it was another kind of covert thing. I put Fred in the little, Toyota Hilux he had, and I drove him over there, and, she gave him an exam, and he let her poke him and prod him in places, you know, that he didn't even know he had. And she was, like, just really impressed by his temperament, and just like, I can't believe, you know, you found this dog on the battlefield. And she was like, the best she could do was she gave me, like, a form that she typed on with, like, British Army letterhead. And she's like, if this helps, use this. But, like, and it said, you know, this dog is cleared for travel, you know, and something like that. But, it, you know, it wasn't by any means. She didn't fill out the customs forms or the veterinarian forms or anything like that. But it gave me peace of mind, and it kind of gave me, in my own way, you know, it really justified, you know, what I did, which was essentially gather the appropriate forms and I just filled them out and made them look as good as I could and paid out of pocket to ship him home commercial through DHL. And that's So that's it. I mean, like, the closest airport I could get him to was JFK. And
well, that didn't matter. That didn't matter though. Once you, so
yeah.
Let me ask you this. You take that back to guys from DHL, and you say, "Is this good enough?" Or did you know that that would be good enough when she handed it to you? What was the point that you knew that he was going to be able to be shipped back to the United States?
That was, it was when I got that kind of that permission. Like it wasn't really permission, but in my mind, it was from that British vet. You know, and it really, it kind of freed me from any, you know, like really feeling like I was doing something wrong. And then from then it was just a matter of getting the right forms and filling them out. And then I put on the top of that stack of paperwork that would accompany Fred from Afghanistan all the way to JFK. I put that British Army letter on the top. So it was the first thing that anybody, any customs official that would be reviewing Fred's paperwork, that would be the first thing they would see. And I treated it like I would like a source, you know, like all the spooky crap we learned at Intel school, you know, like just about hiding in plain sight and, you know, appearance being everything and stuff like that. I just made it look as good as I could and hoped for that. And I took a big, one of those big, mega Sharpies, and I drew like a big USMC, you know, Sergeant Fred on Fred's kennel. And I mean, getting a kennel was a whole other thing. That's a whole other part of the story. And we could have a third phone call about how I got the kennel, you know, and it was just a really, writing the book and it was really, you know, reliving all of it, was really special for me. And you know, as I was writing it and as I was typing it, even as I'm telling you, like the anxiety I was feeling during all this is still like, you know, it's still there. Sometimes I still can't believe that I was able to pull it off, but it's, you know, it was worth it.
Alright, so that's the, that's just him getting home. Who picks him up? When do you meet? And then I'm curious about how the idea comes for the book. And then what does Fred? Okay, so who picks him up? And then when do you get home? And then I want to go from to the mental health side of this because that's not a small piece of this.
Right. Yeah. So I my dad and my sister drove up from Virginia to JFK, and they were waiting for him at customs, and they, you know, that's a really cool scene in the book, you know, just when he comes through and, you know, there's that moment where the customs official is like reviewing his paperwork and my dad and my sister are like, aren't sure, you know, if he's going to make it, you know, if they're going to let him through to the other side of this little partition. And so 4 months later, I get home and my dad, my poor dad, you know, is taking care of this wild dog. And Fred actually didn't get his first bath until he got to the States. My sister gave him his first bath, back at my dad's house. And she always talks about just the layers of crud and sand that, were coming off of him. And that was when she really realized, you know, how real it was. Yeah, and then so yeah, 4 months later, I come home and I'm stationed at Quantico, and Fred and I are reunited, and that's a really cool moment, and it wasn't until, you know, relatively recently that the book really became, you know, fixed in my mind as something that I needed to do.
Explain that. So you come home and like everybody else, you begin to deal with the monster that's under the bed.
Yeah.
And talk to us about how Fred's really role in your life probably gets bigger than at that point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I transitioned, you know, I use that word loosely, But I moved into civilian life really quickly. And I was, if you looked at me from the outside, I had nothing to complain about. I had a new truck. I had an apartment. You know, at the time I had a fiance and I had a great job with great pay. And, you know, it was really, material wise, like, you know, everything looked fine, but, I was really hurting on the inside, and I was really struggling to find just relevance in my day-to-day life, and the DIA was not doing it for me. You know, coming home every day to Fred is what did it for me. And knowing that even if I spent the last 8 hours at a desk, you know, pushing a mouse around and not really feeling like I'd accomplished anything in my day, I would come home and see that little weirdo waiting for me, and he was proof of what I was capable of, if nothing else. It was like, you did this, man. Like, the dog is here, you know, because of you. And that's, you know, that's the power of rescuing an animal at all. It doesn't have to be a story like ours, you know. It doesn't have to be this fantastic thing where you sneak them out of the battlefield, you know. But if you rescue an animal from a local shelter and you come home from work and you look at that dog or that cat, you know, like that animal is there, you know, because you rescued it, and now it's, you know, it's this special little being that, you know, really revolves around you. And he was just this example to me of, you know, what I was capable of, and also what was possible when, you know, when we're stubbornly positive, when we really commit to a life of being positive no matter what, because that's, you know, that's what he was. That's why he stood out to me so much, on the battlefield and from the other sprays that we saw. And so, you know, little by little, his philosophy and the way Fred lives his life, was kind of seeping into me. And, you know, I think he really kept my head above water on those days where I come home from work and really just feel the life kind of beat out of me. And, you know, he would practically throw my running shoes at me or you know, boots at me, and we would just go for a walk or go for a run around DC. And it really just kind of kept me going. And then little by little, the story started to come around, and because people would ask me on street corners or dog parks or anywhere we would go, you know, like, what kind of dog is that? You know, and little, like, the next thing I knew, I was talking to strangers about Justin and Sean and the recon guys I served with, and the battles we saw, and the places the places we went, and, the villagers that I worked with every day, and just war, you know. And, it was through those little everyday interactions with people around DC that it really started to show me how powerful not just our story, but just stories in general are. And then when I left the DIA and went back to school, and my very first class at Georgetown was a writing class. And, it was just kind of a boot camp kind of class to get you into the mindset of academic writing.
Right.
And, it really, that very first paper I wrote, we had to write a paper a week, and that very first paper I realized I loved it. And I love to write. And even in an academic setting, I enjoyed the assignments, and I enjoyed sitting down and putting my thoughts, you know, out on paper. And, over the course of my 3 years at Georgetown, I really, really figured out that writing was and storytelling was what I wanted to do. I talk a lot in the book, a big part of the book is a road trip I went on in 2015 with my friend Josh, who I met at Georgetown. He's an Army vet, and he's an amputee. He lost his right leg to an IED in 2009. And we actually met in Georgetown at class. And the two of us, Fred, you know, did the whole country in like 8 weeks. We spent, you know, just exploring and goofing off all over the country and camping and stuff. And after that summer, I was really just dedicated to sharing our story in any way that I could, and to getting a book out there. Because it's just from from D.C. to Seattle, like, people reacted to it in different ways. I mean, it was important to people for different reasons. And it was clear to me that, you know, the story was bigger than me, you know, and it was the reason that I was able to get Fred home, the reason that I made it home in the first place, you know, is to share this story and in turn, you know, just show people, you know, that's something important. It doesn't matter if you were turning wrenches on helicopters and for 4 years and never left the States, you know, or whatever. Like, if you served, you have stories, you know, and they're important. And, you know, that's something that it took me a while to make peace with and to figure out, because I think, you know, just we're told so for so long and in so many different ways, you know, that we're not special, you know, and it's not really, you know, especially in the Marines, like, we're, you know, you don't want to draw attention to yourself. You don't do things for that reason, you know, and that's not why I got spread out, and that's not why.
Well, hey, Craig, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
When somebody,
sorry, I'm ranting, man.
No. It's the story. It's the story. When somebody in the Marine Corps says, "Oh, you're special, huh?" What does that mean?
Yeah, it just means you're. I don't know. To me, it was always, you know, like, it was always just kind of a.
Never, it's never a good thing. I can tell you
never
that.
Never good. Yeah, exactly. It means you're trying to, you're doing something for the wrong reasons, or you think you're better than anyone, and that's, there's always going to be somebody to check you, and that's, I love that. I love that about the Marines. I love that the moment you feel like you are special, someone is gonna nip you, you know, and remind you of some Marine that came before you that did it way better, you know, and that humility is so important, and it's what I think one of the things that makes Marines different from you know, everybody else, is that you know, that constant reminder of you know, of what, you know, you know, the standard that we have to live up to, that impossible standard of the Marines that came before us. So
my guest is Craig Grossi. He's written a book called Craig and Fred. It's a story and you've been listening to it, of how he brings a stray dog back from Afghanistan to the United States. It's a pretty improbable tale, to be honest with you, but he's pulled it off. Talk to us about the mental health piece of this, and because I'm sure there's people out there that are struggling that don't have a pet. And I have two. We've had a Jack Russell Terrier. Jack is about 8, so we got him in 2009. And, you know, animals provide unconditional love. No matter how horrible your day is, when you come through the door, they're fired up. And then, and then I got Jack a companion, Joe. I like one syllable words, because when you're mad, you can yell them really quick. Jack and Joe is kind of the criminal element of the family. He's just a puppy. We got him from a rescue a little bit north of San Diego. And talk to guys, because, you know, as you a little bit earlier, Craig, were talking about guys getting killed. And you'll never forget that. You'll never get over that. And then, you know, you come back home and, you know, you begin to kind of deal with that. How does it work? You know, how do you process it? And what has been the role in Fred as you process that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think processing it is, there's no finish line. For me, at least. And I think that's, you know, I think that's something I thought I needed to have for a while. I felt like, you know, it's just this thing I was going to eventually process and be done with. But I realized for me that's not the case, because, you know, I think what's most important for everyone to realize is that it's different for everyone. And processing it, you might reach a finish line. You might reach a place where you're at peace and you can let it go. And that's great. And that's you know, that's you. And that ultimately, everybody's going to have to find their own way. And I think that's important for people to realize, because I think as veterans and as active duty or whatever your situation is, we can be made to feel like it's this step-by-step kind of thing that, you know, okay, first you do this, and then you do this, and then, you know, and if you don't, along the way, if you miss a step, if you don't do it the right way, you know, you're going to mess it up, you know, and that's just not, you have to find your own way to process it. And for me, storytelling and talking about these guys and talking about Fred and talking about Afghanistan has been, you know, my way. And you know, that's where, you know, I think Fred played a huge role, because, you know, people, I'd be walking Fred and people would ask me, you know, like, what kind of dog is that? And eventually I would start to just tell them, you know, and people had no idea what they were signing up for. People did not think, you know, they were about to get into a conversation with a combat veteran, because, you know, like I had a beard and, you know, I had like, you know, I looked like a college kid probably, you know, but, you know, 30, 40 minutes later, you know, we're talking about night patrols in Sangin, you know, and it was awesome, you know, and so that, for me, that was therapeutic, because I think for a long time, I felt like, you know, I had to do the old school kind of veteran thing where you know, like, oh, that's my Uncle Craig and he doesn't talk about,
right,
you know, and like that was kind of the betrayal to me, you know, because the only combat veteran in my family was my Uncle John, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge and was like, his whole platoon was wiped out. He spent 2 weeks, you know, missing an action, like running around the German lines in a German trench coat, like just trying to make it home. And, but he didn't talk to Uncle John about it. He didn't talk about it, you know, and so that was kind of the example for me. But I realized, you know, that wasn't working, you know, and the stories were gonna come out, you know, anyway. And it led to a lot of unhealthy situations where I was just drinking too much and it was coming out that way. And that's not going to lead to anything good. So yeah, Fred was my valve, I think, for releasing those memories and letting them live.
So let's talk about the decision to write a book. Where does that come from? Because a lot of guys roll around with these kind of cool experiences. So you get Fred back here. Where does the idea come? Just a little bit of breaking news. Let me interrupt here for a second. A group of Senate Republican women, or I'm sorry, Senate Democratic women, call on Senator Al Franken to resign amid further allegations of sexual harassment. So, in a lengthy statement posted on Facebook, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said she was shocked and disappointed. Senators Mays Hirano, Democrat from Hawaii, Claire McCaskill, Democrat Missouri, Maggie Hassan, Democrat New Hampshire, all made their views known relative to Franken via Twitter. While Senator Franken is entitled to have his ethics committee conclude its review, I believe it would be better for the country if he sent a clear message that any kind of mistreatment of women in our society isn't acceptable by stepping aside to let someone else serve, she wrote. Anyway, so that's breaking news. Now, let's go back to your decision to write. So a lot of guys have these experiences. You've had this transformational experience after you've written. What made you write? Who enabled it? How did it work?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of different circumstances. The most important, I think, was going back to school and just figuring out that I liked to write and that I liked to tell stories. And then from there, it took support, you know, and I'm really lucky to have specifically my girlfriend, Nora, has been, even before we were together, she was really driving me to write, you know, and I sent her some of my early kind of scribblings of our story of Fred, Fred's story, and she was one of the first people to ever tell me that I was a good writer. And just, I don't think she realized at the time, like, how important that was for me to hear, because in the veteran community, and specifically the Beltway, like, I didn't have a lot of friends that, you know, were creative, and she's a musician and a songwriter,
she's from the land of the hummingbird.
Yeah, correct. Yeah,
and we are not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I figured her opinion, you know, would really matter to me, and just to hear that it was good, you know, and that I should write more. She also was, you know, like, this is good, but we want, you know, I wrote about Fred. You know, and that was the easy part for me to write about. And she was like, but you're going to, you know, people want to hear about you, and people want to hear about Craig. And that wasn't really what I wanted to hear. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it was about the first step is to get, overcome your own kind of boundaries and restrictions that we put on ourselves. And that's, those are the hardest ones to overcome.
Was that easy for you to begin to go to places that are pretty sacred to most guys? And, you know, it's like, nah, you know, I'm okay writing about Fred, but, you know, in terms of writing about, you know, about other Marines, how they died, how I felt about it, I don't know that I want to do that. What was that neat? How did you get over that?
I went to a veterans writing project. It's a nonprofit, and they do stuff all over the country, but they're based out of DC, and they do free, you know, the one I went to was the 2-day kind of crash course in, you know, in writing your story and like memoir, you know, kind of, structure. And it's a really great organization. And it's run by this guy, Ron Capps, who's a former Green Beret, and he wrote a memoir about his career, and the very first thing he said on day one of the seminar was like, look, like, if you're in this room, and I looked around the room, and there were, you know, spouses and, you know, children of military people, you know, service members, and there were a couple of Marines in there that, you know, had, you know, one guy was a double amputee, one guy was a single amputee, like, these guys had come really close to death, And he looked around the room and said, like, if you're in this room, like, it's your duty to tell the tale. Like, you made it back, you've had the experiences that you've had, and it's on you now to share your story and the story of those you served with. And the way, just him putting it like that was, like, just stuck really hard with me, because then it was like, I looked at it completely differently. And I looked at it as like, yeah, like, this isn't me, like, beating my chest trying to say how cool I was, you know. Yeah. And it's about something bigger than me.
So this is
and
not.
And once I wrap my head around that,
do you think that's how most Marines look at it? Like, this is not a dig me event. This is something different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think right. Yeah, I think that's our mentality, you know, like, yeah, we never want to draw too much attention to ourselves. Like, we want to lift up the people, you know, that we serve with, and
Hey, so, you know, around Marines, this is just my opinion, but if you thought, like, yeah, I'm going to write a book about me, you know, what would the reaction to that be?
I wish I could go back and like say that in a room of Marines, like, I would love to hear this. It would just be lots of really sarcastic chirps about, like, oh, you, like, what are you going to write about? Like, how many pull-ups you did in the mirror, you know, or the way you like this shirt looks good on you, or like, I don't know, like, yeah. Something really demeaning.
How you were scared shitless when we were getting shot at. Right? All that kind of stuff. No, it is humorous. The message in your book, Craig, is a very, I think you used the word positivity with me the other day. A lot of time, that's somewhat of a foreign concept in our culture anymore. Explain the power of positivity and your message.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because the recon guys would give me a lot of crap about it because the PMA, positive mental attitude, was, in the grunts is a non-existent thing. I mean, a grunt needs a couple of things and, some dips, a couple of magazines and the right to complain whenever they feel like it, And for me, I always kind of had a solid PMA, and I was always ready to find something good, like a cup of coffee in the field, was all I needed. And I don't know. I was always kind of,
And let me just say, so as a grunt, right, there's these sayings, right? Hey, look, if we wanted you to have morale, right, we'd issue it to you. Okay.
Right.
Were you ever issued it? No. Okay. Then shut up and do what I told you to do. Okay.
Right.
Nobody cares how you feel or what you think. Just do what I told you to do.
Right.
Yes, Staff Sergeant. And off they go. Yeah. Right. We don't care. And so that's the attitude you get. We live at the bottom of the food chain. It's rough out here. You can bitch and complain all you want, but when I tell you to do something, we're about work, so get your ass moving, and that's the low place on the totem pole that you exist, and that's their own like dark black sense of humor about positive attitude. Shut up with that shit, okay? Just move, just move.
Yeah.
So keep going. I'll tell you what, it's hugely important in our culture, my opinion, because kids, for whatever reason, seem to go so negative so early, and it doesn't take much to derail them, because I don't think they're raised. I think they're raised now with parents that hover over them and insulate them from life's consequences, and so when they do hit bumps, the bumps are magnified because you haven't developed these coping skills. I think because, your parents intercede with you with coaches, with teachers. And so I think encouragement, positive mental attitude, I can do this, is arguably more important now than it ever has been in our culture.
Yeah. And the thing is, stubborn positivity, like the little philosophy that is a big part of my story in the book. And it's a different kind of positivity because it's not this like, naive kind of approach to being positive. It is like embracing the dark, grunt kind of ability to complain and be negative, and it's so, appropriate for that because there's always going to be a reason to be negative, and that there's room for that. There's room to complain and to kind of get it out. But as long as you circle back around and are grateful for, I guess, nothing else, your opportunity to complain and for somebody to, at least one person or just yourself, hear your complaint.
Well, again, in the world that you lived in, right? You didn't have to look very far for examples of guys who weren't around. And so just the very ability to complain is a privilege because none of us had to search very far, for the true lessons of life in that, hey, man, you're lucky you're bitching, okay? Because I'm sure, he'd still like to be bitching, but he's not here anymore. So,
That was Fred, kind of like the way he handled himself and the way, he was positive really rubbed off on me and the recon guys and those guys that had seen their share of dogs and had seen their share of more than their share of war and just the consequences of it, but Fred, his demeanor really just like broke through all of that, and it was one of the reasons I really just feel like our story is so special and so important, you know, because and two Marines, like two people that have served in that environment, you know, they'll really see, you know, like how unique Fred is and was, you know, in that time.
So, as you go around, has the message changed? Fred becomes what, a symbol of that which is possible when you're positive. When you go around and speak, what's the message?
Yeah, the it's a lot of things. Now, I mean, I it depends on, you know, where we're at, but it usually starts kind of just, you know, with a little bit of my story, and then I go into, you know, what, you know, what made Fred stand out, you know, and what that was, you know, and what that means to the rest of us, you know, and I talk about, you know, like the idea of, you know, like we're stubborn about so many things, you know, in our lives, and none of them are any good, you know, most of the time, and my girlfriend's laughing at me right now because she knows it's true, and but we can take that same, you know, kind of power, you know, that we put behind being stubborn and put it into being positive, you know, like that. You know, Fred is an example of, and I guess me too now at this point, you know, like we're an example of what is possible, you know, and you know, that's kind of what our story is, like when we talk now, that's kind of a lot about what we go into and also just what it's like to struggle with, you know, with life and not knowing, you know, what direction you're supposed to go, you know, cause this time last year I was working a retail job in DC, you know, and,
how was that?
I was really kind of frustrated with, you know, with life, and I graduated.
Come on. Retail's awesome.
Retail is awesome.
That's the biggest bunch of bullshit, man. If you ever want to promote hating life, go work retail, man. You'll hate life very quickly.
This was a sweet spot though, because they let me bring Fred. That was, and it was a cool little store.
Oh,
it,
really?
So it was just a platform for me that people would come in and try to, you know, one of my socks or a shirt, you know, and I would just talk to them about Fred. So it's in terms of retail gigs, this was a pretty cushy one.
Okay,
but,
that's not retail. Okay, what you were doing, I don't know what you were doing, but that's not retail.
Yeah.
So now do you have a schedule about do you tour the country now, telling your story and speaking? What do you do? How do people find you?
Yeah, I mean, the best place to go is to just go to fredtheafghan.com, and you can find our
Fred the Afghan.
Fred the Afghan. Yeah, that's all of Fred's social media, all of our stuff on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter is all Fred the Afghan. That's our own, like, little kind of, we've created a logo based on that, and it's just kind of, you know, what Fred is, you know, outside of the book. And, FredTheAfghan.com has all of our,
is your hair still that long?
Yeah.
You embrace the civilian lifestyle. Nice.
Yeah, well, I'm a hockey player too, and we like our, I play hockey when
stop it. Don't even tell me you're going to grow the mullet, or I'll like stop
you. No, we like our flow though. We like the little hair coming out of the back of the hockey.
That's true. What about hockey, the best sport on the planet, by the way? But, and my Kings last night crushed the Minnesota Wild.
Nice.
Talk to us about, In I'll hold you for a couple more minutes, but there's a young reader's edition to all of this. Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, that's really cool. It's just structured differently than the adult. So it's more chronological in terms of the chapters, and in terms of the adult book, it weaves, you know, from Afghanistan to the States and kind of back and forth like that. And then just the language is, you know, there's no cursing or drinking, in the young reader. So but the story is still there, and it's still, you know, the message is still a big part of that. So it's really exciting.
All right. I've got
cool to have both versions.
I've got an email question for you.
Yeah.
Mac has Fred adjusted to life in the United States? Was there any adjustment period for him, or did he simply bask in the glow of the love of Craig's family?
Hey, yeah, hang on. Hey, man, sorry. You can just leave it right there. Hey, man, sorry. I guess the UPS guy just showed up.
No, that's all right. That's all right. You take care of him. My guest is Craig Grossi. He's a former sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. Worked in corrections initially. Got out, came back in as an intel Marine. He meets a dog in Afghanistan by the name of Fred, and he's now written a book. There's an adult version and a young reader's version of the book. All you got to do is go to fredtheafghan.com. You'll see them both, along with Craig's long hair and nasty beard. You'll see all of that there, and you can watch a trailer for it. So Craig's been gracious enough with his time to join us twice and to tell his story. And it's a story not only of how they meet, but also coming back and dealing with, there you go, Fred introduces himself. Dealing with the demons that you deal with post combat and Fred's role in all of that as they are partners. So anyway, the young reader's version, you were just finishing up with that.
The story is still there, you know, and it's designed for readers, you know, 8 and up. But it's been cool to have people reach out and tell me, you know, about like they're reading it, you know, my fellow veterans and just people, you know, from all different backgrounds are reading the adult version while their kids are reading the young reader, like right alongside them. And,
that's cool.
You know, it brings up a lot of tough subjects that people can now kind of address, you know, through our story with their kids, you know, and some of my close friends from the Marines and, are, you know, talking, like, hey man, I didn't know how to approach, you know, my kids about, you know, so kids always ask tough questions, you know, and they want to know about war and about stuff like that. And now this has been a place, for them to kind of start that conversation and have a, you know, have something to kind of go off of when they talk to their young people. And that's something that I could have never anticipated. And it's right. So, it's so cool, you know,
how do you explain it? I remember, we were driving down the 405 in California, and my daughter, who's 14 right now, probably was after I got back from Afghanistan, so she's probably 11 or 12 at the time, this was a few years ago, and she looked at me and she said, does it bother you when you guys kill people?
Right.
And I thought about it, and I said, Colleen, it's more fun than going to the water park. Right? She screams, and she's laughing, and she screams, and she looks at me. She goes, that's awful. I said, it is awful. I said, but, Colleen, they do such bad things to innocent people, and then they try to kill us. And so if I were to be honest with you, and I will, no, that doesn't bother me one bit. I could do it all day. You know, and it not bother me because of the things that I've seen them do. And I said, I know that's hard to understand. So it's not like killing somebody who's innocent. It is like killing something that's bad. And so you feel good about it. I said, I hope that makes sense. And she said, well, and it is interesting that you bring that up. She said, well, I don't think about it like that, I guess. What I think about is it's another person. I said, yeah, I don't think about it like that. To me, it's a bad person doing bad things. And so if you had somebody with a gun running around shooting people in the neighborhood and doing bad things, if I shot and killed them, what would you think? She said, I'd be happy.
Yeah.
I said, there you go. There you go. And I said, what gets you to water park happy is they're trying to kill you. You know that.
Right.
They're trying to kill your friends, your comrades, guys you fight with. Yeah. And so that's why. So now when she sees like them on TV, like ISIS or the Taliban, she'll look at me and she'll say, water park. And I said, yep.
That's great. That's all. Yeah, man. And it, it's important to, I mean, to get there, you know, how else could she ever think about it other than just killing another person? You know, if you hadn't had that conversation to her up until that point, you know, it was just killing another person, you know, and it was just that really, you know, direct kind of thing. And it's just, it doesn't work that way. And it's all about just communicating perspectives. And I think that's a tricky place to be. But we all kind of have to get there one way or the other. And I'm just pumped that we have a young reader, that can kind of go alongside with this. If it helps, you know, one person kind of bring that subject around, then it'll have done its job. So I'm pumped about that.
All right. His name is Craig Grossi. He's a former sergeant in the United States Marine Corps. He's a writer now. And, if you go to the website, FredTheAfghan.com, you'll see his books. You'll see a video, trailer of the book. You'll see pictures of Fred. Very, very cool stuff.
Yeah.
Craig, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on twice, not once. And,
No,
I thoroughly enjoyed hearing your story, and good on you for doing what you're doing. And congratulations on not only going through that experience, but coming back. And I always say what we owe our friends that didn't come back is to live better. And you're certainly doing that, bud. And anytime that you're doing something that I can help you get the word out, just shoot me an email. You got my email. So shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to help anytime, any way that I can.
Awesome.
And all the best of luck to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. And I'll stay in touch because we're planning on heading west this summer. So we got a lot of friends out there. I want to reunite with all the recon guys, and a lot of them are out in California. So we'll definitely give you a heads up when we start planning our events and stuff out west.
All right, man. All the best of luck. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep, there you have it. That is Craig Grossi. He is the writer of a book entitled Craig and Fred. Very cool stuff. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to go long today. Eric Hamill is going to join us next, and we're going to talk about the Chosin Reservoir campaign. So don't touch that dial. He is a prolific author of Things Marine. I think the name Eric Hamill is synonymous with Marine stuff. In fact, this is the first book ever written about the Chosin Reservoir campaign, and you'll hear him talk about doing this research, some of it for the first time when he did it. So don't touch that dial. Again, my thanks to Craig Grossi for coming on. The book is entitled Craig and Fred. It's a great story, an improbable story. And with the emphasis on, you know, being positive in life and working at things and being positive and playing it forward, and ultimately good things happen, which is kind of a universal truism. If you need an example for it, read the book. You can read it with your kid and spread the word. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on a Wednesday edition right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.